Okay, on the Jodcast, many times in the past, we've talked about nice, pretty pictures that you get from telescopes. And with this being an audio podcast, it's usually quite difficult to communicate what's on these pictures. So we've asked our own Tim O'Brien to give us a rundown of some of the sounds you can hear from space.
Okay, right. Thanks, Stuart. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing, the idea of sounds from space. I mean, we're used to observing the universe. So, you know, the vast majority of information we get from space is in the form of different bits of the electromagnetic spectrum. So all the way from radio waves to X-rays, and, you know, our eyes just work a little bit in the middle there somewhere. So the idea of sounds from space is a bit weird. And I think the one thing that I was reminded of when I first started thinking about this idea was a film that I'm sure you've seen yourself, which is Alien. And if you go back and find the original posters for Alien, you'll see that the tagline was, "In space, no one can hear you scream."
And that's because there's a vacuum, or near vacuum in space.
That was the idea, yeah. So what they were picking up on was the fact that actually sound waves need to travel through, you know, when they travel through the air, when I'm talking to you now, and people are listening to this, the molecules are banging together, and eventually that wave hits the eardrum and bangs on it, and that turns into a signal that the brain interprets as a sound. And because there's very few, you know, the density of the medium in space is so low, you know, like one particle per cubic centimeter typically.
That's pretty low.
Yeah, it's virtually a vacuum. People sort of interpret that as there being no sound in space, or at least the Alien filmmakers did. and in fact, of course, there are actually sound waves in space, because there is stuff there. It's just that the density of atoms is so low, it'd basically be inaudible. So if you took your helmet off in your space suit.
Yeah, which I don't advise any of our listeners to try.
That's right. That's the public information announcement. Don't take your space helmet off. But if you tried to listen, then it'd be basically inaudible, because, you know, there's not enough atoms there to bounce off your eardrum particularly.
But some bits of space are more dense though, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, when you get closer into a star and stuff, and we'll see some examples of sound waves in this thing we're going to talk about now, actually. But, often what's done is a thing called sonification, where we could actually take electromagnetic signals, radio waves or whatever, mm-hmm. and turn them into a sound, to sort of engage with them in a different way, you know, which is sort of interesting. So hopefully.
Like we do when we turn them into pictures.
Exactly. I mean, you know, all you're really doing when you're collecting stuff from space is you've got to get that information into your brain to let you think about it, to try and understand what it means. And what we're used to doing is putting visual information into our brain. But there's no real reason why we shouldn't listen to signals, or we shouldn't even smell signals, maybe.
That's making me think of the Contact film with Jodie Foster with her headphones on listening to the VLA now.
Jodie Foster was, that's exactly it. And of course, people don't sit at the VLA with their headphones on, and neither do they make scratch and sniff radio maps. But I've got it down as a little thing I might consider at some point in the future. Okay, so what I did a little while ago, last year sometime, I took the output from the Lovell telescope here at Jodrell, and I recorded it onto, basically we took the electrical signal that comes out with the receiver, and you can put it through an amplifier and send it through a pair of speakers, and I recorded that. And this is what, if we sat there like Jodie Foster in Contact with our headphones on, and we listened to the signals from our radio telescopes, this is what we'd hear. Now, I'm sure you'll agree, and I'm sure the listeners will agree, that this is particularly interesting.
It's riveting. But now all our listeners who are sat there probably with their headphones on are reenacting the scene of Jodie Foster in Contact, listening to radio noise.
Absolutely. This is what she was so interested in. Now, of course, the thing about that is that, it's not interesting. Of course, radio astronomers don't sit there with headphones on listening to signals like that all the time. It was actually pointed at an interesting object. That is a recording of the radio signal from Cassiopeia A. There's two big bright ones, actually. There's Cass A and Cygnus A, and Cass A is a supernova remnant. Just depends what frequency you're observing it as to which is strongest. Cass A is a supernova remnant. We think it exploded in about 1670.
About 300 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. So those radio waves are being produced by electrons accelerated in the shockwave around that exploded star. But there's not a lot of information in that signal other than its strength. So really what you're doing is measuring the strength of the radio signal at a certain point in the radio spectrum. And that's what radio astronomers will be interested in.
That's like the loudness of that sound.
That's effectively the loudness of that sound. That's where the information is. But the rest of it's just noise, you know. It's not that interesting.
It sounds very much like when you tune your radio out of the channels.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, that's why we don't typically listen to signals from our telescopes. We'll hear some more unusual ones later. Now, I've got a recording here that was made by a guy called Don Gurnett, who's at the University of Iowa. And it's actually, we'll start sort of close to home and work our way out into the universe, I think. And we'll start with the Earth. And this is a recording of something called Whistler waves. So I'll play that now. Okay, so what you heard there was a lot of whistling.
It was.
You agree?
Yeah, I do.
So there was a bit of a pew sort of sound.
So what are they?
Okay, so basically what they are is they're actually waves in a plasma. So plasmas are charged, you know, charged particles. So, you know, when you get any atoms and you sort of rip some electrons off them, you end up with a mix of positively charged ions, the bit of the atom that's left behind when the electrons are ripped off, and the electrons. And that's often what stuff is in space, and even in our atmosphere and above the Earth, so at high altitudes. So what happens is lightning strikes. So when a lightning charge, you know, shoots through the atmosphere, that sets off a disturbance in this plasma, and that plasma wave travels along the magnetic field lines of the Earth out into space. Yeah. And that then generates this, basically this radio emission that you can hear as these whistlers.
Right.
So, and the sort of the way in which the tone of that note changes is telling you something about the way in which that wave propagates along that magnetic field, travels along the magnetic field.
They started quite high in frequency and
decay away. So the boom, boom is the sort of, if I was to do a very particularly poor impression of it. So those are whistler waves. Here's a second example, a related thing. They're actually picked up by spacecraft flying above the atmosphere now. These things are called proton whistlers. Now,
ones were with electrons?
Largely electrons, right. Yeah. So they're largely waves in the electrons. These are waves more in the proton proton component of the plasma. And actually, they're sparked off by the whistlers. So you basically get this sort of lightning strike down near the surface of the Earth. That sends this whistler, the first sort of electron whistler wave up through the magnetic field. And then you get a sort of proton wave that comes back down again, we think, down through the magnetic field. And they sound quite different. And because of the fact that one is largely in electrons, the other is largely in protons, you get a difference in the tone. And you also get a difference in the way the tone changes. So what you're going to hear, what you should listen out for, is you'll hear whistlers. You'll hear the ones like we just heard, the boom, boom. But after a few of the stronger whistlers, you'll hear this sort of eerie, ghost-like proton whistler sort of kick in after it. So just try and listen out for that.
So the whistlers there sounded a bit like some kind of laser battle in a sci-fi movie.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
by the ghostly echoes.
Yeah, I mean, those ghostly things are really good. You get a boo, 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 boo from the laser battles, the electron whistlers, and then you get the ooh sort of noise from the ghostly proton whistlers. It's great stuff. Sticking to the Earth. Here's some recordings of meteors. Now, in fact, these recordings were made with, so these are shooting stars, basically. These recordings were made with a system, that we've got at Jodrell Bank, which was set up by a few people there a few years ago, Megan included, and Eddie Blackhurst as well as others. So what happens here is that, if you can imagine this, Spanish broadcasting station, or, you know, down in Spain there, sending out their signals, then normally you'd expect to get that in line of sight. You know, you'd have your aerial on your roof or something, and you'd pick up that signal directly.
And up here in Manchester, we're quite a long way out of line of sight from
Absolutely.
Spain.
We're not going to get line of sight to Spain. So the only way we'd normally expect to pick up that signal is if somehow it got reflected back off the ionosphere, the upper part of the atmosphere. And what happens here is that normally we wouldn't pick up the signal at all. But then when there's a shooting star and it sort of shoots through the atmosphere, it leaves this ionized trail of gas behind it. And the radio wave that's being sent out from the Spanish station can actually reflect back off that
trail. Right, so it gives us a mirror up in the ionosphere.
Yeah, there's this echo coming back. So you're right, the meteor acts like a mirror in the ionosphere, and we get this sort of echo, this reflection off this mirror. So what you'll hear in this recording that we made with the aerial that's set up at Jodrell, you'll hear high-pitched noises in this recording that are basically the echo of this transmission coming back off the meteor trails. So these are actually the Leonid meteors. So that actually, you know, the thing we do with that sometimes is we have these meteor shower star passes at Jodrell where we hope that maybe the skies are clear and people will actually see the shooting stars. But of course, yep. If it's cloudy, which, you know, it's very rarely cloudy, of course, here in
never in Cheshire, never.
But when it is, then we can still sort of see the meteors, if you like, through the clouds. Okay, moving out away from the Earth a bit, we get to a planet, and Jupiter's a nice example of something that produces radio emission, which we can turn that radio emission into sound, and this is something called the Jovian chorus, and it's supposed to sound a bit like the dawn chorus, you know, all the birds and stuff twittering as dawn approaches. So, in fact, I think it sounds like the jungle, actually.
Yeah, it sounds more like the jungle than the dawn chorus in Winchester.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a few howler monkeys in there as well, as well as your macaws and stuff. So, you know, quite interesting stuff. Here's another aspect of Jupiter's radio emission. And this is, you know, radio waves quite often are generated, you know, we see a lot of this idea of electrons and charged particles spiraling around magnetic fields producing radio waves. And here's the magnetic field of Jupiter. And these are things called S bursts. This comes from Dick Flagg at the University of Florida, this recording. This is low frequency radio emission. And it's coming from the magnetic poles of Jupiter. Now this recording, this is real time.
Right.
And it's a bit, you know, I don't know, it just sounds a lot of crackle and...
Yeah, and it almost sounds like someone's tapping away on a table.
Yeah. So there's sort of, you know, you've seen a lot of variable strength to the radio signals. You'd actually, sometimes what you think is, well, maybe there's a lot more information in that than we're managing to hear. So what you can do is change the speed at which you listen to it. You can either slow down the signal or you could speed up the signal and then see what it sounds like, because then you're then able to...
compress the time or expand the time.
Yeah, that's right. So here's speeded up by a factor of 128.
Ooh, it sounds a lot more like the whistlers we had earlier.
Absolutely, and it's because it's exactly the same thing. So it's the same physical thing that's happening in the sort of magnetic field around Jupiter as happens in the magnetic field around the Earth.
So why is it spread out a lot more in time?
Well, I think it's basically to do with the magnetic field strength, you know, and the scale of Jupiter, which is different. So you can imagine that the same processes might happen, but on different timescales. So yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so heading out from Jupiter, let's get to Saturn. And the biggest moon of Saturn is called
Titan.
Thank you. So if you look at Saturn through a telescope and you see the lovely rings, of course, you'll probably spot nearby it what looks like a very bright star somewhere fairly close to Saturn. And in fact, that is Titan. You know, it is visible through a small telescope quite clearly.
Currently with the Huygens lander sat on its surface.
Absolutely. So when the Cassini spacecraft went to Saturn recently, it took this Huygens lander and it dropped it through the atmosphere, and it went down through the atmosphere of Titan, and landed on the surface of Titan and brought back the first pictures from the surface of Titan there. And it's, you know, Titan's interesting because it's got this sort of thick, soupy atmosphere, and we think maybe something like the same sort of chemical composition as the Earth's atmosphere might have been, you know, a long, long time ago towards the beginning of the solar system. So what this recording is it's actually a recording of the radar signal that was being used by the Huygens lander to work out how far above the surface it was.
Right.
So if you can imagine, if you're sort of floating down on your parachutes, you want to know how far it is to go, and the scientists back on Earth want to sort of have this telemetry that measures what the spacecraft is doing. They send out this radio ping, and the ping comes back from the surface.
So it's just like a submarine does.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a sonar type arrangement, but in this case with radar radio waves.
Yeah.
So basically, you're sort of pinging this thing back, and what should happen, of course, is that as you get closer and closer to the surface, the time between successive pings gets shorter and shorter as you get close to the surface. So we'll listen to that. The first part of the sequence is actually there's something to do with the radar system locking onto the signal. So there's some sort of funny little blips and wiggles at the beginning, and then you'll hear this sort of high pitched tone. And the tone will increase as the spacecraft approaches the surface because the pings are getting closer and closer together. So this is it locking on.
So it's trying to get
the lock on the returning signal. It'll kick in a minute, in a few seconds. Going up, you hear these clicks getting closer and closer together, getting closer and closer to the ground. You can imagine if you were on the spacecraft, you'd be thinking, here comes the ground, brace yourself for impact. And it has a camera on board swinging around, taking pictures as it was going down. You might be starting to get worried now.
Yep.
Here comes the ground. So that was it. That was it landing. So that was quite a shock, a jolt to the system.
Okay, so now we've landed nicely on Titan. Let's move out from the planets.
Yep, move to a star. So the nearest star
is the Sun.
Not Proxima Centauri. I'm sure you know that.
It's a trick question.
It's a trick question.
Trying to catch me out there.
Back to the Sun. You might be aware the Sun effectively rings like a bell. I mean, basically there's sound waves passing through the Sun causing it to vibrate all the time. So here we've got a recording. It's actually made, again, it's made with data from the, Michelson Doppler imager, it's called, which is on board the SOHO spacecraft. So what this is doing is it's looking at the Sun. And it's measuring the spectrum of light from the Sun, and it's measuring the Doppler shift in that spectrum. So as bits of the Sun come towards us, and there would be blue shifted, and as bits of the Sun go away from us, the light would be red shifted.
So this is just like a police car coming towards you away from you. The pitch gets shifted.
Absolutely.
Down or up.
Yeah. So if you listen to a car driving past, as it's, you get this sort of sort of sound. Yeah. So as it's coming towards you, they get a high pitch. As it goes away, you get a low pitch. So you can do this. So you can take the data from the sort of images of the Sun being produced, take that Doppler shift measurement and turn that Doppler shift measurement into a sound.
Right.
And that's what's been done to produce this recording. And in fact, in this case, like we said earlier, sometimes you get more information if you speed things up or slow things down. This particular thing has actually had to be speeded up by a factor 42,000.
That's quite a lot
to hear something in the signal. So this is a lovely humming sound. It's the sound of the Sun just humming, you know, just sort of,
it's,
you know,
quite
just
relaxing.
Vibrating. It is quite relaxing. Just listen to the Sun.
But this is 42,000 times faster than it would be.
Yeah. Yeah, because the Sun's so big, you know, the sound waves would be much longer, so you wouldn't hear that sort of those vibrations unless you speeded them up. There's a huge range of sound waves, however, on the Sun, and this is just one example.
And in fact, some Some people use those sound waves to probe into the sun, don't they?
Yeah, and it's called helioseismology. So, you know, helio as in sun, helios. Yep. And seismology, just like with earthquakes, where, you know, an earthquake goes off somewhere on the earth and the sound waves travel through the rock and right through the earth. And you can put seismometers, things that detect those waves at different points on the earth, and you can study the interior of the earth by looking at the time at which you detect these signals from different parts of the earth. Mm. And you can do the same with the sun. It's a really neat way of studying the interior structure, which would otherwise be invisible to us. Here's another one related to the sun, and this one's to do with the solar wind. So we know the sun's got this wind of particles that blows away from the sun all the time, energetic particles. And this is two spacecraft called the Helios spacecraft, German-US collaboration. And this is, again, data from particles hitting the spacecraft in the solar wind, and the sort of changing energy of those particles and the number of particles that hit has been turned into a sound for us to sort of interact with the data in a different way.
Now, those of a certain generation might say that that sounds a little bit like the theme tune to the Magic Roundabout.
Yep, I don't know what people were on when they made that, but it's interesting stuff because it's basically those sort of tones. You can get these tones because in this case, it's the energy spectrum of the particles. So you might imagine that high energy particles you could represent by high pitch sounds and low energy particles you could represent by low pitch sounds. And then you can take that information that's embedded in the energy of the particles and turn it into an interesting thing to listen to. So, and it's actually quite, it's interesting in itself, it's a different way of it, but actually I think it's scientifically useful as well sometimes, because you can actually sometimes hear, you know, for example, a little high energy particle might arrive, you might not notice it in a huge slew of data that you're looking at visually on a graph, but if you listen to it audibly, you suddenly hear this high pitched tone, and it stands out quite markedly from the rest of it, so it's not, you know, it's got scientific value as well, actually.
And in a sense that was a real sound, because it was the transmission of energy by particles. Hitting the spacecraft.
Absolutely, yeah, it's similar to a sound wave in that sense. Yeah, that's right, rather than the sort of electromagnetic wave conversion that we've done. Here's something that I was involved with a couple of years ago. I worked with a few artists in a group called Flow Motion, called Anna Peaver and Eddie George, and they sort of approached me with some data they'd got from Phil Utley at Southampton University, which was X-ray observations of Cygnus X1. Now, Cygnus X1 is a binary star system that we believe has a black hole in it, and material sort of falls from the other star into the black hole, and as it falls towards it, you get a conversion of gravitational energy to heats the material, and you can get that material gets very hot, and it can produce X-rays. So these are basically X-rays observed with a satellite called the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer, and what they wanted to do was make a sort of work of art, a sound piece, and associated visuals, working with those data. And so I took the X-ray data and I turned them into a sound for them. So this is sort of my interpretation of materials. It falls into a black hole, never to be seen again.
That's got a really good beat, but what exactly is that telling us?
Yeah, so the beat, which is one of the most interesting things about it, is actually because the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer measures very rapidly. It samples the X-ray brightness many times a second, actually, right. Or in this case, I think it's about 20 times a second, in fact. So what that beat that you hear is effectively separate measurements of the X-ray brightness. I've slowed it down a little, so it's sort of dum 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 dum, is us measuring the X-ray brightness. And then all I've done is a very simple thing where I took the X-ray brightness and said if it's brighter, I'll make it a higher pitched sound. If it's fainter, I'll make it a lower pitched sound. And then I just turn that into a sound. And it's just a sort of a different way of looking at the data rather than simply looking at a graph of it. Mm. Now I'm going to remind you of what a typical radio signal recorded with a Lovell telescope is like. pretty boring, I think we agreed. However, we can imagine moving our telescope off Cassay, the exciting supernova remnant that produces the rather boring sounds, pointing in another direction in the sky, and this is what we hear. Again, a recording made with Lovell Telescope. So I think you'd probably agree that, that, you know, if you did that and you've been used to hearing the hiss, the static beginning, and then you heard that, you'd...
It's suddenly something quite interesting.
Yeah, your headphones might fall off, you'd fall out of your chair, you'd be a bit shocked. And in fact, the first astronomers that picked up those sorts of signals, it was actually Jocelyn Bell working at Cambridge University in 1967.
Who we talked to last year on the Jodcast.
That's right. And it was the 40th anniversary of her discovery, made in 1967, which are these objects called pulsars. And the pulse obviously comes because these things pulse. When, of course, when she first picked them up, they were... really didn't know what, had any idea what these things were. They thought they might even be alien signals, and so they named the first one LGM-1, Little Green Man 1. So we now know that they're rotating neutron stars. They've got very strong magnetic fields. These neutron stars are maybe the size of a city, 20 kilometres across, but the mass of the sun. So it's like taking the sun and compressing it down to the size of a city. When you do that, it spins faster because it conserves angular momentum. And because they've got strong magnetic fields, you get radiation coming off the magnetic north and south poles that, as the star spins, sweeps past our line of sight, and you get a lighthouse effect. So you get this flash of radio waves every time the star spins.
Every time the pole comes past us.
That's right. So we can turn that into a sound, that radio wave. Again, we can just take that electrical signal, play it through an amplifier and a pair of speakers, and you hear that thud, thud, thud. So that thudding sound was the rotation period of the star, about 0.7 seconds, the neutron star in that case.
What was the pulsar that we were listening to?
That's a pulsar with the exciting name of B0329+54, I think.
Wow, okay, a telephone number name.
Yeah, it's just its coordinates. So the 0329 is it's a right ascension of 3 hours and 29 minutes, and the +54 is its declination of +54 degrees. So that was, you know, that's maybe a typical pulsar spinning once every second or so. This is quite an exciting one. I like this one. This sounds like somebody on the bongos who's drunk too much coffee.
So what's the period of the?
The period of the pulsar in this case, this is the Vela pulsar. It's at the centre of the Vela supernova remnant, and the period of the pulsar is 89 milliseconds. So it's going round about 11 times a second.
Right.
So the sounds are the same. Each pulse is not the same strength as the previous pulse. There's a lot of syncopation, right?
Yep.
So it's going up and down. So that. So in fact, you know, with a pulsar, you find out when you compare one pulse to the last pulse, they don't actually look the same. You know, the brightness effectively is going up and down, is changing. So you get that really lovely sort of syncopated beat that you heard in the Vela pulsar. That if you take sort of the average of 100 pulses and compare that to the average of another 100 pulses, then they look very similar. But from one pulse to the next, there is a lot of variation.
Right.
Here's the Crab pulsar. So the Crab pulsar is at the centre of the Crab Nebula, as you might imagine. So
it's a star which exploded in 1054 AD.
That's right. Seen by Chinese astronomers, so as a naked eye, as a star in the daytime sky, so it was so bright. Point your telescope there, now you see that lovely optical view of the Crab Nebula.
This is M1.
M1, yeah. First object in the Messier catalogue. But deep in the heart of it is actually the remnant neutron star, the centre of the star that exploded, collapses in on itself to make a pulsar. And this is a recording of that pulsar rotating about 30 times a second. So this one sounds a bit like a road drill. You know, that's sort of same. Sort of sound of a road drill. Okay. So, you know, perhaps getting slightly harder to listen to, actually. It almost starting to get a bit painful.
All blending into each other as well. The pulses almost.
Yeah, that's right. So you get thud, 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 but 30 thuds a second. And this next one, the last individual pulsar we'll listen to is rejoices in the name of B1937+21. This is actually the second fastest pulsar we know. So a few years ago, we did discover a faster one. Spins about 10% faster. This one, amazingly enough, remember this is a star, weighs about as much as the sun, about the size of a city, 20 kilometers across. This star spins 642 times a second.
That's very fast.
That is very fast.
What speed is the surface going at?
It's about a seventh the speed of light. So
that's very fast.
Yeah. So in fact, you know, obviously we imagine, and it took a long time before we found a pulsar even going slightly faster than this one. We imagine there must be some limit at the speed at which they'd spin because they might pull themselves apart, basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, the material, it's telling you something about the structure of a of a neutron star, looking at how fast they can spin. Let me just play that. So I think you'll agree that this is not something you're going to listen to for any great length of time, but bit painful.
No, thank goodness for that.
So it's basically a note of 642 hertz is what you're listening to there. So that's so those pulsars that spin that fast are spun up in binary systems. We think stuff's dumped onto them from a neighbouring star that adds angular momentum and spins the star faster.
Right, so that's how it gets.
That's how it gets to be that fast. That's right. Now that note, that 642 hertz note, you know, you can imagine. Okay, that's interesting. It's a note, you know, like one might play on an instrument. And you know, you could take a set of pulsars, all spin at different speeds. They effectively give you all different notes, and you've got a musical instrument, because you can play those pulsars perhaps and hear lots of different tones together.
Yep.
And what we've done actually, Michael Kramer's produced a nice recording of an ensemble of pulsars in a globular cluster. A globular cluster in this case called 47 Tucani.
So a globular cluster is a big group of stars.
Yeah, that's right. So these are these sort of the globular, the spherical bodies of stars, groups of stars. Several million stars. Absolutely amazing. They're one of the best things to look at through a telescope. You look through a small telescope, what are you going to look at? The moon? Yeah. Jupiter? Yeah. Saturn? Yeah. Globular cluster? Tick. Yes. You want to look at a globular cluster. So, yeah, 47 Tuck is a globular cluster in the southern sky. And we've basically found, 20 or 30, fast spinning, so-called millisecond pulsars, because they spin with periods of several milliseconds, tens of milliseconds. And this is a sort of recording of a fly through this globular cluster. So as you fly through, what you heard was, you know, you hear all the pulsars together, if you like, from a distance. And then as you fly through the middle of the globular cluster, you can sort of whiz past one pulsar after another, and you start to hear one pulsar louder.
That gets louder as you get closer.
Yeah, and they all play at sort of different notes. And those are the real sort of notes that each of those pulsars have.
Mm. Very soothing sound. It's much nicer than B1937.
It's not bad, that's true. Okay, most recently on pulsars, I'm sure we've talked about this a number of times on the Jodcast. We astronomers here at Jodrell discovered a thing called the double pulsar. And the double pulsar is, two pulsars orbiting one another, which is the first time anybody's ever found such a thing. So, you know, we'd heard of one pulsar going round another, neutron star before, but these are two pulsars, so it's two clocks orbiting in a strong gravitational field, best ever test of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Recently, the most recent result from the double pulsar was to look at the eclipses, because it turns out one pulsar passes in front of the other, and when that happens, the magnetic field of that pulsar effectively blocks the signal being received from the other pulsar, so you get a real eclipse. So there's basically a recording of that eclipsing happening, and we'll just listen to that. So what you hear is the tone of the pulsar before it goes into an eclipse, and then the spinning magnetosphere, the region with the magnetic field around the other pulsar that starts to block it. So you start to hear it drop out.
Fading in and out.
And it's basically as the other star spins, it blocks it more and more and more.
So the magnetosphere around this pulsar is not spherical, it's in some kind of,
it's a sort of
donut shape.
Yeah, that's right. It's a sort of donut shape, and as it spins, that donut sort of passes in front of the star and then reveals it again, and then blocks it and then reveals it again. And as the stars are more closely lined up, then it disappears for a long period of time, and then it starts to hear again out the other side.
So if our listeners were to get a skewer and stick it through a donut,
yeah,
across the diameter,
yeah,
and then to spin the donut on the skewer,
that's the one.
In front of a light, they would see the light coming in and out.
That's exactly what it's like. And in fact, there's a lovely movie of it that's been produced, that we'll link to from the website. Okay, right. I think we've done a lot of stars. We've got quite far out of the universe. Let's go back to the beginning of the universe and let's think about the Big Bang. If you were to listen to the Big Bang signal just directly, it would just sound like hiss. So it'd be very much like that hiss that I recorded coming from Cass Air.
Yeah, because it's fairly uniform across the whole sky.
So. Yeah, that's right. So it would be sort of static. It's just a hiss. There's a very interesting sound that was made a little while ago by Mark Whittle, though, at the University of Virginia, which is that he took sort of models of the way in which the universe would have behaved as it expanded over its first million years. And there would have been sound waves that pass backwards and forwards, you know, through that material as the universe expands. And he's basically taken that information, our physical understanding of how that should work, and he's turned those sound waves into a real sound. So it's as if you this is as if you're listening to the first million years of the history of the universe, and it's the sort of information that's imprinted in the cosmic microwave background radiation, the sort of CMB maps of the sky. That obviously you know quite a lot about working on Planck.
Yep.
So here's his sound. So remember, the first million years of the universe. That was it. A million years in a few seconds.
It sounded like something being shot out of a cannon at the beginning.
Yeah, I think the initial thing is basically you can imagine the scale of the universe is increasing, so there's this sort of decaying frequency goes on. If your listeners are interested in the details of that whole process and exactly what all these things represent, I think they should visit Mark's website, which we'll link to from the Jodcast website, because he's got a great amount of detail as what the background astronomy is and the science and how he actually came up with that, with those particular sounds. It's worth reading if you're interested in more. And I think just to finish, it's probably worth, now we're talking about the Big Bang, it's probably worth reminding people that, that actually if you tune your TV set, off station, so get to a blank channel on your TV set.
Which is getting harder to do with digital TVs, but...
That's true. So, you know, on your normal TV where you've got these numbered channels, if you find one of those numbered channels that's not got a TV signal in it, you're just going to see static on the screen, and you could turn the volume up on the TV and you'll get this hiss. It's worth noting that a few percent of that static, a few percent of the radio signal that's coming, that's arriving at your aerial and coming down into your TV set, is actually from the Big Bang. It's radio waves that...
It's amazing to think of that.
Yeah, produced 300,000 years after the Big Bang itself. At the time the cosmic microwave background radiation was produced, the universe was a temperature of about 3,000 degrees. It would have been, that light would have been visible, would have been a sort of dull orangey-red colour, so the universe would have sort of glowed orangey-red, because anything at 3,000 degrees would be that sort of colour, you know, even like Betelgeuse or something, the red giant. And then as the universe has expanded by about a factor 1,000 since then, it's now down at about 3 Kelvin. And anything that's at a temperature of about 3 Kelvin would radiate in the radio part of the spectrum down in the sort of microwave end. And that's basically where your TV signal's tuned to, your TV is tuned to pick up signals of that frequency. So yeah, a few percent of that static is truly, really radio waves that set off, just after the Big Bang.
That's amazing. Well, Tim, thank you very much for taking us on a sound tour of the universe. And my only advice now is for all our listeners to go home and tune their TV in between the channels and watch the microwave background.
And listen to this.